through. So we're largely talking here about two articles that me and Julia published both last year, where we've been collaborating on language ideologies and inequalities in schools. So the first article I'm going to talk mostly about that we published in Language and Society last year, called The White Ears of Ofsted, A Raciolinguistic Perspective on the Listening Practices of the Schools Inspectorate. And then Julie's going to talk about a literacy article, A Lot of Them Write How They Speak, Policy, Pedagogy and the Policing of Non-Standard English. So this work is based mostly in, well, actually exclusively really in England's schools, for reasons that will become clear as we especially start talking about Ofsted. But I'm aware that there is an international audience here today. So I'll give a little bit of context about England's schools and the very special whether people from settings outside of England have experienced or witnessed similar things in terms of education policy from wherever you might be joining us from today. So just to give a little bit of historical overview of schooling and what's called school inspections in England. So in England, all children between the ages of 4 to 16 go to school. That's divided into primary and secondary with those ages there, with very high stakes assessments at the end of each of those phases. And crucially for what we're talking about today, all of those schools are subjected to quite regular inspections, so once every 3 or 4 years or so, by what's called the Office for Standards and Education, or as they're commonly known as Ofsted. So those inspections last 2 full days. Inspectors come into schools, physically into schools, where they do a number of activities, observing lessons, chatting with staff and students, gathering various kinds of data. They also publish their own policies, so guidance for schools. They have a methodology for those inspections, and recently their own so-called research reviews. And at the end of those inspections, they rate schools out of 1 of 4 gradings, so outstanding, good, requires improvement, or inadequate. And those outcomes, it's kind of difficult to capture just how enormous those implications are for schools in terms of funding, reputation at a local and both national level, league tables in terms of how schools are ranked, and also things like staff morale. And crucially, in how schools respond to a good or a bad Ofsted rating in terms of what they do next. So all of those inspection reports are publicly available online, and that's what we're really going to focus on today, which is where we gathered the majority of our data on for this work. So our work began then a couple of years ago, back in June 2020, where we noticed what we found to be quite troubling things going on in a number of different inspection reports of schools that we were looking at. And we were interested in particular how the inspectorate perceive what students are doing, and indeed what teachers are doing with their spoken language. So here's one of the early, this is an extract from an inspection report. And this gives a really good indication of the kinds of perceptions about language that Ofsted were making in those published inspection reports. So where they're making those ideological associations between pedagogical quality, student engagement, teacher ability, etc., with the presence or the absence of certain categories of language, such as standard English, academic language, speaking clearly, speaking properly, etc. And so that led us to really craft two research questions, which is, well, what kind of evaluative perceptions are the inspectorate actually making about language, particularly speech, but we're focusing exclusively on speech here. And how do those perceptions about language relate to the racial and socio-economic characteristics of the school? So in other words, are they just making perceptions about language, or are they also making perceptions about the kind of communities that are producing that language? So we call Ofsted in our article the White Ears of Ofsted, and our focus is not just a kind of set of biological ears, really, but we're very insistent that what we're talking about here is an institutionalized mode of perception which enacts various kinds of surveillance in school, including spoken language. So Ofsted have a really long history. They go back to colonial times in the mid-1800s, which is where they first emerged as an institution. They're overwhelmingly white, so they publish their staff statistics, and the recent round of staff statistics showed that 92% of those Ofsted inspectors are white, earning a decent salary. So they're white, they're middle class. And so they absolutely embody what Jonathan Rosa and Nelson Forrest call the white listening subject. So an ideological position which can be occupied and both enacted by, yes, individuals, but mostly institutions, policies, assessments, tests, curricula, etc. Considering that, then, we also take constructs like standard English and correct grammar, etc., to be reflective of what are called language ideologies, so sets of beliefs about language, which typically define linguistic benchmarks along the lines of idealized whiteness in terms of who gets to decide what counts as standard, what counts as non-standard, what counts as correct, what counts as incorrect, etc. So our focus is on interrogating the whiteies of Ofsted in terms of what they're doing and the perceptions that they're making about spoken language. So really quickly then, so I've talked a little bit about language ideologies. So language ideologies are really deeply institutionally enshrined in England, especially the standard language ideology, which can be traced back at least to the early 19th century. Lots of early associations between standardized language practices and class coincided with the development of the schools inspectorate in 1839. In addition, British colonial expansion, as well as other technologies of linguistic standardization at the same time. So to critique what Ofsted are doing with language and what they're perceiving about language, we take what's called a ratio-linguistic perspective, where we turn attention away from the stigmatized speaker and turn attention towards what the oppressive listener, in this case Ofsted, in terms of how they're perceiving, in terms of how they're listening, and in terms of how they're judging and categorizing different communities in terms of what they're doing with their language. So our methods were drawing upon Nelson Flores's ratio-linguistic genealogy then, which insists that we ought to reject those linear narratives and that things what seem to be the past actually continue to shape the present, that notions such as standard languages are simply products of social and colonial constructions which have been built on the logics of colonial practices and the systems of white supremacy. And finally, taking that ratio-linguistic perspective, which shifts attention away from the stigmatized speaker and towards those in power. So this is how we gathered our data then. So first of all, we visited the National Archives in London, where all of the what we're calling historical inspection reports are held. So here's a picture of me at the National Archives, and looked at hundreds of those reports. And the bulk of our data was this corpus of 100,000 contemporary reports, which were published online between 2000 and 2020. And we created a random subsample of 3,000 purely because of the quite overwhelming size of that corpus. With that corpus, then, we were then able to, as Raquel Vessey does in her work, trace language ideologies in corpora. So through some quite simple manual searches like speak quick, clearly, correct grammar, proper grammar, academic language, non-standard English, et cetera, et cetera. And then finally, where we saw a presence of a language ideology, looked at the type of school where those inspectors were making those judgments about. So were those schools in low socioeconomic areas? Were those schools serving majority racialized students, for example, in order to make that connection between perceptions about language and perceptions about different speakers? So the archival work was super interesting because that really kind of doubled down on this idea that language policing is totally foundational and totally kind of normalized within the inspectorate practice since they began in 1839. So we found an overwhelming number of evaluative judgments about speech, some of which I'm showing here. So everything in purple here is taken from examples from inspection reports that we found. So lots of praise given to schools where pupils and teachers were perceived to be producing these impressive habits of pronunciation or appropriate articulation. On the other hand, lots of criticism handed out to schools where it was deemed that they were failing to actually pay attention to deviant speech. So from 1949, for example, the speech of many children is of insufficient worth and therefore something needs to be done about it, i.e. schools need to intervene and make sure that students are producing, according to the inspectorate, what is adequate language. Lots of discourses of poverty and cognitive inability and ignorance, which became ideologically associated with a purported lack of standards in language. So from 1920, far too general weakness was shown in the pupils' command of their own language. That's ill-constructed, it's ungrammatical, and there's evidence of poverty of vocabulary and ignorance of the meaning of words used. So the foundational work was really important because it absolutely gave us that argument that language ideologies, and in particular raciolinguistic ideologies, are a totally normalised feature, and we would actually argue a design feature of the inspectorate's work. Post-2010 then, there was a shift in policy in England, and Ofsted were granted even further powers by the government, and that resulted in a real ramping up of standards-based reform, lots of which was to do with the capacity to produce academic and standard language, in which students and teachers are being instructed that that's an important part of school. So a succession of policy documents such as training guidance shows that Ofsted were actively encouraging inspectors to see more formal approaches to correcting spoken language. The teacher's standards, which is a set of mandatory guidelines that all teachers must follow, force and police student teachers' use of correct and articulate standard English, and a 2013 report on literacy in schools really kind of double down on those logics that policing non-standard language is done in the betterment for the betterment of marginalised children. So an extract from that report says, in another inner city school, I think it's actually from East London, this report, where students are coming from working class backgrounds, staff were paying close attention to essentially policing their language and praising the idea that pupils were then quick to police themselves when they chose to use non-standard features in their language. So thinking about our corpora then, so we were able to trace language ideologies in our corpora. So here's just a screenshot of what that corpora looked like. So we have the schools on the left, and then this is just a screenshot of us searching for that phrase, speak clearly. And even from then, I'm just looking at that now, right? And you can see that there's a whole number of presence of language ideologies here. So on line 23, for example, teachers speaking clearly and fluently. So again, the big question here is, well, who's getting to decide what constitutes clear and therefore unclear language? And how does that impact upon associations of so-called clear speech and pedagogical quality, teacher engagement, etc.? So teachers face language policing. So here's some more recent extracts. Overwhelmingly, we found then that there was active approval given to schools to engage in what we would call quite hostile language policing. So where teachers were being praised for their insistence that students might answer questions using so-called correct grammar, where students were being challenged to write and speak accurately with the absence of slang or colloquial language. Excuse me. Again, that ideological association between quality of speech equated with quality of teaching. So the idea that if a teacher is deemed to be producing standard English, then that's with the, that, then that's for the betterment of pupils. And in 2002, the kind of active seeking to eradicate local accents and local dialects from the classroom, and that being deemed to be still a powerful, albeit bad, influence on the spoken word. Consequently, then, things like non-standard English were then getting perceived through a barrier to learning. So where some adults were perceived to have weak spoken standard English and grammar, this means that they're modelling bad habits or teaching incorrect grammar. Staff need to do more to correct pupils' poor language or vocabulary. I had a summary there, but I'm just going to skip to the next slide, Julia, because I'm just conscious of time. So children also had their language policed in the inspection report. So absolutely those deficit ideologies about children's speech being very normalised in terms of the inspectorate's work, again, tracing that back all the way back to the mid-1800s, with those very same deficit logics still present in 2004. So students being perceived as displaying poor speaking skills, limited vocabulary, weak grammar, poor articulation. And crucially, what we found then was that the most hostile acts of language policing were especially reserved for schools with large communities of low-income children and those children that were racialised in some kind of way. So here's an extract from a school report in Mossside in Manchester, one of the most economically deprived parts of the country, serving a large majority of Black Caribbean students. So whereas the more able pupils are deemed to be speaking standard English, and that's deemed to be making good sense, the less able pupils are deemed to be producing non-standard English, which results in some confusion, with TH fronting there being targeted at as a particular feature that ought to be eradicated from schools. And finally, what we found is that we saw this reproduction of so-called word gap ideologies with discourses of linguistic incompleteness. So things like often reverting to phrases, one word answers or gestures, and again, phrases like limited vocabulary, simplistic sentence construction, deemed to be handicapping students. After we'd done our work, then this actually came to light after we'd published our work, we found, and really this kind of gave credence to what our argument was in the paper, that language policing is not just a set of individual mistakes, it's not just a set of things that individual inspectors do, but it's actively written into the fabric of the inspectorate's practice, and it's actively something that's done by design. And indeed, that's really important because our analysis have never been interested about individual inspectors, but about an institutional structure which is built on those logics of racio-linguistic ideologies. So recently, there was some confidential training materials for inspectors leaked, which really proved that this structure and these logics of racio-linguistic ideologies are actively woven in to the inspectorate's practice. So from those leaked materials, we saw guidance for inspectors like this. Teachers should also appropriately correct people's grammar. There are high expectations, they speak standard English. And as Julia is going to talk a little bit more about, this indeed is a matter of social justice. We would reject that and frame that as a view of social justice, which simply places the burden on marginalised speakers to modify the way they talk and isn't anything about social justice, but just simply maintains those racial and class hierarchies that are so embedded in society. I'm going to hand over to Julia. We're going to do a quick swap of slides.
I'm going to quickly share my slides. Okay. So can you see that? Can everyone hear me? Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. So as Ian has just indicated there then, Ofsted increasingly drawn discourses of social justice in its policies, especially in relation to language. So they position standardised English as part of the cultural capital that they say children need to acquire in order to achieve at school and later in life, where standardised English will purportedly allow them to go on and get good jobs and thus achieve economic and social mobility. So in evidence submitted to a parliamentary inquiry in 2020, a representative of Ofsted literally referred to standard English as an instrument of social justice. However, we resist this simplistic idea that equity is solved through modifying individual language behaviours as opposed to dismantling the institutional structures which exacerbate racial and class inequalities. This meritocratic myth that if only marginalised students would modify their language practices to conform with benchmarks set by white listeners, then this will solve social inequality, is a core tenet of the racio-linguistic ideology that Ian's been talking about. Research shows us that actually the white listening subject, in this case, the school's inspectorate, will simply continue to hear these students' language as insufficient, regardless of whether or not they're using standardised language, because institutional assessments of what is standard versus non-standard are really just measures of how well a student is able to embody particular subject positions of idealised whiteness, for example, rather than empirical linguistic practices. Now, for us, social justice is only possible through the dismantling of structures and the redistribution of power rather than the linguistic assimilation which underpins the inspectorate's approach. In fact, we argue that the inspectorate's approach will serve only to exacerbate class and racial inequalities. First, it simply reinforces the authority of standardised English and the notion that there is only one correct way of speaking, which involves emulating the speech of white and economically privileged speakers. Well, this will benefit white and economically privileged speakers much more than it'll ever benefit the less privileged children that Ofsted purport to champion. Second, Ofsted judgments about language filter through into Ofsted's judgments about language filter through into local school policies and pedagogic practices, where they can have negative consequences for teachers and pupils in the classroom. And given that, as Ian said, Ofsted reserve their most hostile comments for teachers and pupils in schools which serve areas of social and economic disadvantage and that serve communities of racially minoritized children, we can expect these adverse effects to be most keenly felt in these schools. Now, a teacher that we spoke to in Leeds recently referred to this as a domino effect, a fitting metaphor, we believe, for the negative cumulative impact that Ofsted can have on teaching and learning. And I'm going to share with you just a brief example of how this domino effect works in practice. So our analysis of Ofsted inspection report showed that Ofsted often conflate speech and writing and promote the unevidenced notion that talking in standardised English bears direct consequences on the development of pupils' literacy. And this confusion between speech and writing is most apparent in their focus on full sentences, a phrase they've used to frame people's spoken language as being limited and struggling on the one hand, or high attaining on the other, as in the examples you can see on screen. Now, our analysis also highlighted Ofsted's surveillance of non-standardised spoken grammar. And there were a range of features that were highlighted by Ofsted as being particularly unsuitable for schooling, forms such as ain't, use, we done. But in particular, Ofsted focused on the use of was in second person and plural context, where standardised English would have were. So this received particular attention, and there are some examples there on screen. Ofsted used non-standardised was to make explicit links between the presence of non-standardised grammar in speech and in writing. So in that first example, average and below average pupils in year six still tend to write as they speak. And we was walking is given as an example. Notice there, not just the conflation between speech and writing, but also this link being made with pupil ability. And this is present in the other examples too. So the idea that one of the main barriers to pupils' achievement is their lack of descriptive vocabulary. Many pupils struggle to answer questions in full sentences. The spoken English of the majority of pupils does not conform to standard English, with words like of, have, was and were being interused. And this is apparently hindering their creative efforts. The final example there, a minority of pupils sometimes forget to write in standard English, and they intersperse their written work with words or phrases used in their everyday speech. Again, we was going rather than we were going is cited as an example. And this is referred to not as a feature of dialect, as we're going to come back to, but as an error in Ofsted's eyes. Now, this idea that non-standardised speech also has an impact on pupils' writing was present in the beliefs of the teachers that we interviewed as well. So you can see some examples on screen which come from interviews we conducted with teachers in Leeds in Northern England. So if their speech isn't up to scratch, then their writing most likely won't be. There's a definite correlation. I think if we don't correct the spoken form, then it does reflect in their writing. They end up writing it incorrectly. It's how they speak at home, and it comes through into their writing. So they see this definite correlation between speech and writing. And as in the Ofsted reports that we looked at, the teachers also identified was-were variability as being a particular issue. So this first teacher, I personally don't think there's ever an excuse not to use was and were correctly, just because it's incorrect, isn't it? Grammatically, it's wrong. I'd kind of say grammatically, it has to make sense. So was and were was a singular, were is plural. So if you're saying we was, it's just not correct. Whereas if they're using kind of stuff from their own dialect or words, particularly Yorkshire, that would be okay. And then another teacher told us was and were are huge, and they come through massively in writing as well. I don't know whether it's a Leeds thing, a Yorkshire thing, an English thing. Was and were they find really difficult, and we do try and correct that as much as we possibly can, both in speech and writing. Now, contrary to this first teacher's sense that standardised was is simply incorrect rather than a dialect thing, actually sociolinguistic research has shown that was-were variation is common to dialects of English worldwide, and that this variation patterns systematically according to social and linguistic constraints. Given this complex patterning, confusion will likely arise for children who are corrected on their use of we-was, especially where this comes without adequate explanation. Nevertheless, the teachers did correct their use of we was, and they referred to top-down policy pressures from Ofsted, but also from the national curriculum and the teacher standards, as being influential in their approach to language. They told us that these policy pressures made them feel that they had to model correct speech for their pupils, and this was often a source of anxiety. So this first quote, a teacher told us that in a previous school he'd worked at, they'd had a negative Ofsted inspection, and that had led the deputy head there to put a big focus on pupils' speech as a way of improving their writing. A second teacher told us, you have to use was and were correctly, and if you're not, the children use was and were incorrectly, and then they write it down incorrectly, and then they're suddenly not writing standard English, and then they're not adhering to related expectation. So here, was were variation in a teacher's speech is presented as having stark consequences, leading ultimately to their pupils performing at below age-related expectation, which would be a really serious issue. So I think this demonstrates really nicely the intense pressure teachers feel to monitor both their own and their pupils' speech. And these ideas aren't specific to the lead school that we worked with. Ian's done an analysis of a larger national corpus of school-designed language policies, which demonstrated that non-standardised grammar and was-were variability in particular is frequently highlighted as a problem in school policies up and down the country. Teacher comments from that school in Leeds are significant, however, because we also analysed pupil writing in this school, and we found that non-standardised grammar occurred relatively infrequently in the pupils' written work. Even non-standardised was, which was identified as a huge issue that comes through massively in writing by their teachers, occurred less than once per thousand words in the pupils' written work. And this was certainly not a barrier to their developing literacy. Indeed, it's been shown, not just by us, but by other studies, that non-standardised forms, which are routinely problematised by Ofsted and corrected by teachers, don't occur that frequently in pupil speech. In fact, some of them, forms such as ain't, for example, just don't occur at all in pupil speech. We argue that teachers are particularly sensitive to non-standardised speech, not because it really is an issue in relation to developing pupils' writing. We, amongst others, have shown that it is not, but because it is highlighted as an issue in educational policy and evaluative mechanisms, including in Ofsted documentation and reporting. So in simple terms then, non-standardised grammar just doesn't happen all that often in pupils' writing, but it is made into an issue through policy discourses and Ofsted reports. Why should we be concerned about this? Well, because of that domino effect that I mentioned earlier, teachers are made to feel that they have to model standard English in their own speech, and they transfer this expectation to their pupils through overt correction of their pupils' speech and other forms of language policing and zero tolerance approaches to language at school. The underlying assumption here often is that improving talk will bear direct consequences on the improvement of writing, but there is no evidence that the policing of speech will help children conform to the conventions of written standardised English. On the contrary, educational and sociolinguists like Ian and I have long made the case that language policing can have negative consequences, impacting on children's confidence, sense of identity, and educational experience. Some students may internalise the message that their own language is not so good, may just decide not to participate in classroom interaction, and these students will miss out on opportunities to participate in the kind of academically productive classroom talk which research has shown raises achievement. And thus we make the case again that the approach to language that Ofsted take actually works against the social justice agenda that Ofsted purportedly align with. To conclude then, the Ofsted, the inspectorate claims that it reports what they see rather than judging against preset criteria. However, we have shown that the inspectorate doesn't just report what they see, but what it hears, making auditory judgments against the imagined criteria of so-called standard English and how far speakers are heard to deviate from the idealised language patterns of the white middle and upper classes. We've shown how the inspectorate's ideologies about language work to normalise school cultures where certain bodies and ways of talking are commended, while others are silenced, with those who speak in standard English constructed as normative and an auditory benchmark to which all are expected to aspire. These language ideologies and policing are a design feature of the inspectorate's work. So as Ian made the case, these are concretised into its practices since its establishment and are now enacted under new, seemingly benevolent guises of social and racial justice. We argue, though, that when understood through the prism of standard language and racial linguistic ideologies, the inspectorate's perceptions of language actually exacerbate racial and social and class inequalities. In addition, their preoccupation with standardised English means that they miss the issues that really do matter with regards to classroom talk. So they overlook, for example, the social role that language plays in effective teaching, classroom management, and social relationships. And their superficial focus on correctness overshadows more productive approaches to language, which could help young people both to develop their linguistic repertoires, but also to engage in meaningful classroom discussion and learning.